Hi, this is Steve, aka at AllAnthar on Twitter, and here are some more of my gaming vexes.
Hey Steve, this is Neil, aka Old Scouser Role Playing on Twitter. I just wanted to congratulate you on a rather fantastic first episode. I thought you pretty much nailed it there. You know, good pace, nice introduction to yourself, raised some good questions there, really. I thought there was some. There's plenty to talk about, plenty to discuss. So yeah, keep up the good work, mate, and look forward to hearing some more.
Hey Steve, it's Che from Roleplay Rescue, and I just wanted to say a big welcome to the Anchor community of podcasters, and especially of gaming podcasters. Us Anchorites need to stick together. Wanted to say I've just started listening to the first episode of your podcast, and I was so deeply and incredibly honoured that you had mentioned me and what I've been doing with DM's Diary over the last 18 months or so. I'm glad that I've inspired you in some way to just to pick up the mic and talk. I think it's really important for people to pick up the mic and talk, and I don't think we need to worry about polish. You know, I think in the end, pick up the mic and talk is really important. So thank you. I'm partway through the episode. I'm going to try and finish it off next time I'm out walking. It looks like from today I could do that later on. You know, it's Wednesday. So anyway, I'm just going to stop witchering. Just want to say a big thank you and welcome to the Anchor community. And thank you for putting something out there at this time. You know, it just really is cool to hear from you. Game on.
Hi all, and thanks again for taking the time to listen. I've been really encouraged by the feedback I had regarding the first episode, either in the form of call-ins like those you just heard or over Twitter. I'll take Che's words to heart when he says it's not all about polish. As you might imagine, it's pretty difficult to put something like this out into the world, but everyone's been very encouraging and supportive. So as you listen to this, remember, you've only got yourselves to blame. So, my gaming this week has been pretty full and very enjoyable and fairly varied, I think. So I've played in Old Scouser Roleplaying's excellent Night's Dark Terror game, which is running using the Old School Essentials rule set. I've also run a session of Swords and Wizardry Complete, which is based on the Daughter of Darnu scenario from White Dwarf 39. I've also run a really enjoyable session of Liminal, which I'll come back to in a second, actually. Liminal is coming towards an end now, and so in the spirit of you buy it, you play it, which is one part of the reason I started this podcast in the first place, I'm now looking towards what my next game is going to be once Liminal's complete, and I'm going to be running a series of Earthdawn 4th edition. I've had quite a bit of interest in this, so I might be running two groups through the same scenario, which is how Neil is running the Night's Dark Terror campaign. I think there's a lot of interest to be gained and a lot of insight, I think, to be gained from how two different play groups essentially approach the same problems. And then finally, I've been doing some work on the Astral Virtual Tabletop. All of my online role playing to date has been using the Roll20 platform. But as Astral is free through till the end of May, essentially you get all the pro features free till then, I've been taking a look at that. And I think it offers something different to Roll20, not least in how it's you can use to put character sheets together. It's a lot easier. Essentially, it's a upload a PDF and just drag and drop. The two OSR games that I've been involved with, one as a player and one as a games master, got me thinking a little bit more about Jeopardy in games. I had quite a few comments on Twitter and a couple of call-ins about this, so I think I'll pick that up in a later episode. And Liminal was one of those sessions where, at least from my perspective, everything went right. I'll be interested to hear what players think, but to me it just seemed to flow really, really well. I was engaged, the players were engaged as they always are, and we managed to end on a cliffhanger leading into what I think will be the last session in a couple of weeks' time. And this got me thinking about how you as a GM know when a session seems to have gone well. What gives you that warm glow, the one that lasts well into the following day? And then finally, regarding virtual tabletops, there's obviously been an explosion of usage over the past couple of months. And I'm interested to hear people's experiences and what makes a really good virtual session from the perspective of a new player. So, of the topics that I brought up last session, or last session, last episode, the one that I think caught people's attention the most, probably equal to that of Jeopardy or Lethality in role-play games, was about investigative scenarios. I've got a couple of call-ins that are relevant to this now, one short and one a little bit longer, and then I've got some thoughts on my own that I'm going to share for further discussion, I'm sure, down the line.
Hiya mate, this is Baz here out of the What Would the Smart Party Do podcast and also your friendly Earthdawn pusher. Really great first cast, really enjoyed listening to that. Thank you ever so much for doing it. On investigations, man, I have a real challenge with investigations. I just find them really hard to do, both to GM and certainly to play. The issue that I kind of fall into all the time is that I want to role play my character, I want to have agendas and drives and personality traits and all that kind of good stuff. But when faced with an investigation, I find the only way to kind of solve them or to move through them as a player is to, well, just be me, really, and try and use my brain. And that's limited at the best of times. So I find it very difficult to pursue investigations and role play at the same time. So food for thought, hopefully something you can chew on later. Thanks, mate. See you soon. Bye.
It's Martin, or at mcookie123, and I thought I'd just respond to a couple of the questions you posited about investigative scenarios. So I'm running Fall of Delta Green at the moment, which is heavily investigative. But you were talking about, Steve, about the idea of the balance between giving players too little or too much information. It's more about approaches, those two approaches about restricting information or kind of giving loads of clues, how that works. I would say that restricting information to players is when, I guess you would say that usually you hide it behind something, most typically a skill role, like library use or spot hidden. So for shorthand purposes, I'm going to call it sort of the Cthulhu approach. And I think there's some really good things about that Cthulhu approach, about restricting information. First of all, I think it makes the players think that when they've got a clue, then that's a really big deal. They've actually won that clue, and it's been some sort of test to get it. Maybe it's even cost them something. I think that it's quite good that if a skill roll is failed and the clue remains hidden, then players will generally have to find a workaround, and that can be very entertaining. It can mean they go and speak to somebody different, I guess, in the scenario, or they think of something that you as the keeper hadn't thought of in order to kind of get round this failed skill roll. It hopefully encourages characters to have quite a rounded skill set, because you know, Cthulhu scenarios can often test something pretty obscure. There's been a few scenarios where reading German has been as important as spot hidden, or art has been as important as your use of a shotgun. And I also think, of course, there's the use of fudge. It took me a while, I think, as a games master to realise that a little bit of fudge was a good thing, and I still think that too much fudge can make you sick, but a little bit of fudge definitely works in some cases. It can be really ham-fisted, could be really blatant, like, look, I'm just going to tell you this anyway, says the games master, or it can be, well, as you knock that bedside table, the book falls to the floor and opens on a particular page, pretty much handing them on a plate. I think that's quite a bad kind of fudge, because I think that does look a bit like spoon feeding. So what you could do, I think, is a lot of systems will have a way you can at least make fudge look a bit more legitimate. So 7th edition Cthulhu, I think has a really good way of doing that. You can push your roll. Or in Pulp Cthulhu particularly, you can burn a bit of luck. And I really like that mechanic, and I've used them. Or you spend a fate point or hero point or whatever, maybe. But that way, at least, kind of, you've got around that problem of the fudge seeming a bit too spoon-fed. likes being spoon-fed. I think there's some bad sides to it, obviously. It can sometimes stymie an investigation. I guess the other approach, and again, I'm just going to shorthand this to the gumshoe approach, which is where you basically make it very easy for players to get core clues. I was suspicious of gumshoe when I first came across it, because I thought it just made things too easy. The players would get all the clues at once. They'd quickly decide that, it's Mr. Sneebly, the janitor of the fairground, let's go and kill him. But in reality, the gumshoe system can work, works very differently from that. The challenge just becomes different. Instead of the challenge being finding the clue, the challenge is sorting through the clues and making sense of them all. One of the good things about that, I think, is that players look for patterns. Well, we all do, I think, unconsciously, but players in a gumshoe style scenario will look for patterns. They've got loads of clues, they've gone round, they've found a bunch of stuff, and now they've got to sort it all through. And I think that can be a lot of fun when players try and come up with all sorts of theories to explain these confluence of clues. Secondly, I would say that it just keeps the scenario moving, and for GMs who want the investigative stuff to take a back seat to action, sometimes it's an easy way to get that transition from scene to scene. In my experience of gumshoe and that approach, it does kind of reward role playing a bit more maybe than sometimes slightly mechanistic Cthulhu approach. But again, that kind of depends on the players, I guess. And I think above all, there's fewer of those moments that I think as an investigative scenario GM you dread, which is those kind of moments where the team has just run aground and there's those awkward silences around the table when they're just staring at each other. There's just the dead weight there. So I think gumshoe can help avoid. In terms of kind of maybe drawbacks of gumshoe, I would never overestimate the amount of time it takes for players to track down a lead. I think players can tend to be very thorough, and so that can take a while. Sometimes look a bit like a sort of info dump, and that can be a bit kind of tedious, I guess, for players to go through, although some players really like it, maybe others less so. So, the conclusion is, of course, that there's no right answer, that I think that there is a balance to be struck between spoon feeding and restricting information, and it's a question of how well you know your players and how well you know the scenario. For what it's worth, I would say that if your scenario is rooted very much in the real world, which I tend to prefer, then I think giving lots of clues that link to the real world can be really fun, because players will make the most extraordinary leaps and links because of their knowledge of the real world. So you're looking at a scenario set in the 1920s, where a player's knowledge of the 1920s might be a bit more limited. So, Steve, that's my brief thought. I mean, I've got some loads of other thoughts about investigative scenarios. What to do to avoid the party running aground in the first place, I think is a good one to think about. And the idea of Deus Ex Machina sort of solutions, I think, is another one to think about too. But I'll leave it at that, because I've nearly done 10 minutes, alarmingly. So thanks very much. Cheers. Bye.
So thanks to Baz and to Martin for those insights, useful stuff, I'm sure you'll agree. So my reflections are two broad areas, really. So the first is how to construct an investigative scenario, which can be a bit of a railroad, that sin of sins. But if a clue Q, is only available at location X, and the players don't work it out or go there, you can get stuck. And obviously, I know Martin touched on this in his calling. And I think you can mitigate this in the system. So gumshoe mitigates this by having spends. So you go to a location and you spend a point and you get the clue, whatever it might be. Or you can have other options like pushing rolls, as Martin says in 7th edition. And the other way of doing this is by having a redundancy built into the scenario itself. So the same clue can be encountered in multiple locations. But that then runs the risk of duplication for players, especially if it feels like they're going from pillar to post just to sort of pick up a few crumbs here and there. Whereas I think most scenes probably need to feel like they're materially moving the storyline forward a little bit. And the other side of it is around pacing as well, which I think is related to the complexity of the scenario, I think. So complexity versus simplicity. If it's too simple, it's not an investigation. So in my mind, an investigation needs to have several steps you need to go through with some reflection and some putting clues together. If it's just A to B to C, then it doesn't feel like an investigation to me. But on the other hand, too complex risks confusing the players and yourself, which tips the game over into the not fun side of things. So having run a total of two investigative scenarios, both of which are created based on a seed of an idea from somewhere else, the game seemed to have had quite a similar life cycle, and with my perception of how the players are feeling being coloured by my own at that particular point. So it seems to me, and again, there's no pretense here to be anything original. I'm sure this is probably out there elsewhere, but this is just my reflections. There's the opening phase. So that's where you set out the issue to be investigated. It's the call to action, if you like. So the initial clues are laid out from the characters and the players, and the story is set in motion, possibly with a few red herrings or distractions to provide a bit of depth. But I think the key here is that red herrings need to be interesting as standalone ideas for the players. You don't want any complete dead ends or things which are gotcha moments where players feel like they've wasted some time just to go around in circles. That's definitely what I would call not fun. But then once you've gone past that initial phase, so just the call to action, you then enter the what I think is the middle phase, so what I call creative confusion. So the players and their characters chase after clues, each clue being as important as the next in their eyes. So whereas the GM knows what's important and what isn't, players will tend to base it either on emphasis from the GM or just based on what they think and what they like the sound of. And the GM needs, obviously the GM knows what's going to happen, what's supposed to happen, but he needs to give the players space to inhabit the world, but be able to bring them back on track without it being too heavy-handed. And at this stage, I think players seem to come up with far cooler ideas than I ever can. So I tried to find a way to make their ideas part of the mystery, even if it wasn't to start with. And the payoff from a player character being able to say, "I knew it!" triumphantly, can't be underestimated. And it also makes you look a genius of orchestration when they see these parts fit together in a way that makes sense to them. And I think this is the phase, the creative confusion phase, I struggle with the most, as things feel unfocused and perhaps a little bit forced, although again the players might see it differently. And I think again this is where having in game a handler or a superior or a mentor or a similar role is key, because the GM can play a part in the world through the voice of the handler without breaking immersion, whilst still being able to help the players clarify their thoughts and gently steer them in the right direction. So in the Judge Dredd series I ran, there was a sector house chief who played the part of their mentor and just ask for debriefs and to help the players sift the wheat from the chaff and keep them moving forward. And as I say, I think this part is the most unsatisfying for me, probably because it has to be so unfocused. Perhaps it's just the control freak in me coming out. But I think the key for me is to know when to move into what seems to be the final phase. So this is where the players have got a good idea what's going on, although having a few surprises and revelations left along the way are fun too, and hopefully leads up to the resolution of the mystery in some way. And again, almost by default, this feels like a little bit more of a railroad, which as a GM, it's always striking that balance between completely unfocused and being a railroad, or whether the players feel that they're being channeled in some way, which again is not fun. But in some way it's acceptable at this point, because this is the conclusion to a whole series of revelations that the player characters have gone through. So what lessons will I take from these games for future series, if I do in fact end up running any more investigative scenarios or series? So what I will do is lay out a trail of breadcrumbs, so things the PCs need to know to move into the conclusion. And a la gumshoe, the characters are going to find these breadcrumbs no matter what. But what I will do is lay out options as to how they can be found. So there might be a low immediate risk to course of action, but a longer term cost. Or the players may choose to take a greater risk now, but with a greater longer term benefit. So for example, in a standard Cthulhu scenario, there's some world spanning plot which is attempting to raise the great old ones. And so if the players continually take low risk approaches, then that clock moves forward and the end game might be more threatening. Whereas high risk now might mean that actually they interrupt the plot much earlier in its life cycle. And so really then it's playing the game to see what happens. The characters will solve the mystery is inevitable. It's a given. But the price they're willing to pay and what happens to the characters on the journey to that inevitable conclusion, it's what's yet to be established perhaps. So those are my thoughts. I'm interested to hear what you think though. So please feel free to drop me a line as always.
Hi, this is Tristan. I also recently woke up from the hypersleep chamber after a 30-year hiatus from role-playing games. I started with only monthly Call of Cthulhu sessions, and I'm up to 3 games, but it was really refreshing to hear about 5 different systems that I haven't had any contact with. I think maybe the Worm Paleolithic RPG sounded really interesting for me. The only common point was Old School Essentials. I'm running that for a friend and his son, which is a lot of fun. But I can see that the system is readily adaptable for a lot of other styles of play. Anyway, thanks for the show, and I look forward to the next episode. Bye for now.
Hi, it's Neil here, also known as Thermal Satsuma over on Twitter. Really enjoyed the podcast, lots of interesting stuff in there. Looking forward to hearing more of your thoughts and what games you've been playing. Hit points in D&D, this is a sort of perennial debate. They're not really physical damage. It's only the last blow that does the killing blow and physically damages you. Otherwise, they're sort of more like fatigue or luck or whatever. I've also seen this in games as like luck points or fortune points or flashlights and smokes in Cthulhu Hack. So they should be seen as a resource to be spent. So hopefully, particularly in one-shot adventures, they should have enough of that resource to get through, to give them the clues or to have escapes from things that would otherwise kill them. So they get through to the end of the adventure with just enough to complete it, hopefully. Anyway, that's all. Cheers. Bye.
Hi Tristan, Neil, and thanks for the call-ins. Given that I want to keep these episodes short, possibly sweet, but we'll see, I've decided to leave discussion of both how to introduce Jeopardy into games and also a deeper look at Worm and similar games in a future episode. In the meantime, I'd love to hear about your best ever session as a GM and what made it special, as well as any reflections that you might have on virtual tabletops from those new to them or from those not so new to them. And I'm also still interested to hear your thoughts about Jeopardy, as I've said, and what the challenges are in running so-called real-world games, such as Worm, Twilight 2000, or similar. So on that note, it's starting to run a bit long, so I think we'll call it a day. Thanks very much. Thanks for listening to another exploration of my gaming vexes. If you've got any thoughts you'd like to add to what you've heard here, or a gaming vex of your own you'd like to offer up for discussion, you can contact me on Twitter at AllAnthar, or you can leave a voice message. The link's on the podcast webpage on Anchor, or can be found in the show notes. Until the next time, may all your games be free of vexatiousness, and be excellent to each other, always.